Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
So it's far harder, far, far harder to find your way, for example, in the Boundary Waters than it is in the deserts of Southern California, because in the deserts of Southern California, if you have your map and you have your compass, and, you know, the sun is pretty much always going to be out. Mm-hmm. So if you know, you have a sense of your directions, and then the mountains, you know, you're looking at your map and you can see, okay, that this mountain, this is probably the one that's on my map here based on the shape of it. You know, you learn how to read the contour lines on your map and so forth. And so you can kind of get a pretty good sense. I mean, you can still definitely get it wrong, but you can get a pretty good sense. You've got really good visibility and landmarks. Whereas in the Boundary Waters or, you know, Superior National Forest.
Trees.
You have trees. Exactly. And, you know, not even that many prominent large hills even. I don't know for sure, but I suspect that far more people, especially percentage-wise, get lost and die probably in Superior National Forest than in the desert of Southern California. But I could be wrong.
Hello, how are you doing? This is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. I hope you are hanging in there amidst this coronavirus COVID-19 quarantine thing we got going on here. Well, I have a treat for you today. We're not going to talk about the virus we're not going to talk about being in isolation, but that's actually kind of what we're going to be talking about, but for completely different and beautiful reasons. My guest is Gail Francis, and she, back in 2012, took a five-month journey from Mexico to Canada along the Pacific Crest Trail that is in the western part of the United States. She wrote a book about it. I had the opportunity to read it, and it was fantastic and really enjoyable. I would not probably pick up a hiking book without a really good recommendation behind it. This one had a really good recommendation behind it. Plus, I know Gail somewhat, and I really enjoy reading. Well, I like to read books, but it's always fun when you know the author. Her book is called Blisters, B-L-I-S-S, parentheses, T-E-R-S, close parentheses. I am so glad I read this. I'm wondering if I had read it, say, when I was 20, I don't know that I would have rushed out and gone on this hike that she did, but I certainly think it would have opened my eyes and confidence and perspective on doing something like this and giving, you know, even just a shorter backpacking trip a try. I'm a city girl. I love the woods. I love nature. I don't like slimy things and bugs. I'm sorry. My parents quit camping when I was born. I didn't have a lot of experience, so I just need to be, like, slowly introduced to slimy things, and I'll probably be fine. Anyway, that is not the point of this. The point is, I had a great talk with Gail. Now, keep in mind that she did this trip in 2012, so it's been a few years, and so we're talking kind of all sorts of things about that experience, about kind of her growth between now and then, and what she might have done differently, the preparation, or lack thereof, because I honestly thought there'd be a lot more preparation. So if you are one of those people quarantined and you are just in a place that you need to get out, well, here's your vicarious opportunity. Check out the book and you can walk through her journey. It's a great little movie in your mind. There's a print version. There's an audiobook version. Got you covered. So check it out. Take a listen to the interview. Go read the book. Lovely thing to do while we're stuck inside during some of these gloomy days. I know it's warming up and that's very, very exciting. Also, I absolutely do not want to forget about this. In the notes of this episode, you will find a link to a Zoom invite. Gail is doing a talk about her book on Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. So hopefully you're catching this podcast as it's coming out at 7:30 p.m. Central Time. So I will link to this. Feel free to pass that link on to anybody. Of course, they can join anywhere they are in the world. Forward the link, forward the podcast, whatever works for you. And Gail also spent a little bit of extra time with me, and we talked about the process of publishing her book. That is going to be on the Patreon page, so you can check that out. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you probably already know it's there. I know this interview is going to sound really, really weird because this was done way back in the day when we were like actually able to sit in the same room together across the table from each other. It was amazing. Remember those times? Remember those times? We were living on the edge, less than 6 feet apart. Okay, I don't mean to make fun. Have fun, not make fun. Please keep the 6 foot rule. Although I just heard this morning that if you sneeze, it goes 25 feet. So I don't know if the 6 foot is good enough. Anyway, all right, here we go.
Having a good time.
You know. Okay. So, Gail.
Hey, Judy.
How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for taking your time.
Of course.
So we've talked about you on the podcast before, but you've never been on the podcast before.
That's right.
You are part of Superior Small Batch.
That's true.
It's very exciting.
Yes.
So, and you guys have some new stuff. Not that this was supposed to be about that, but...
That's right,
but
yeah.
But food is fun, so...
Yeah, Superior Small Batch. So we make vegan foods in Duluth. Well, we make them in Superior. We live in Duluth. And we have our new curry burger, which is now at both Whole Foods co-ops.
Nice.
And also at Wusso's Concert Cafe.
Very cool. Yes. And in very various menus around town
which
is very cool. Well, we are having you here today to talk about a very cool hike you took a few years ago. Wait, 2012. 12. Okay.
Yep.
So a little more than a few years ago. and it's the
Pacific Crest Trail.
Pacific Crest Trail. I don't know why I keep wanting to say Pacific Rim Trail for some reason. I don't know why Rim pops in there. I have no idea. Pacific Crest Trail, which is... goes from Mexico into Canada, and that's a lot of miles.
It's about 2,700 miles.
That is amazing.
Yep, border to border.
Wow. How many pairs of shoes did you go through?
Yeah, I went through, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so actually... my first pair of boots was a colossal mistake. They were fine boots, but not for hiking through the desert. So I got massive blisters. I didn't know what to do. It was so bad, and there was no way to get new boots. So I was in a town that had a Kmart, so I got some really cheap boots that lasted for 10 days, and I was like slicing them up because they weren't fitting right. And then the next town I came into, I couldn't find any cheap boots, but I found some tennis shoes, and those lasted about another 7 days. And by then I was able to, by then I was out of the desert. And so then I was able to go back to my original boots.
Okay. It's interesting that it's different footwear, like for those types of things.
So most people actually, I would say, don't wear boots at all. They wear trail runners.
Okay.
And so in that case, they probably just wear trail runners all throughout. But they'll go through. So whereas I went through, I only went through really two pairs of good quality boots. And then actually, I think I'm wearing. Oh, no, I'm not. and then the pair I ended with, I still have. I mean, but people who do trail runners, they go through a lot more, even if it's high quality trail runners, just because they're not as durable.
Okay. So, this very long journey, how long did it take you to do?
About a little more than 5 months. Okay. 5 months and a week, I think.
Okay. And so, I just finished reading your book that you wrote about this called Blisters.
Blisters. So, it's for, since for people are listening, it's the word bliss and then in parentheses, ters. So, it's blisters, but bliss spelled with two S's.
And very interesting to me because it's a journey I'm pretty confident I will never take, and I'm really okay with that. I would love to like pop myself on various parts of the trail
right.
and see and, you know, walk in, walk out, but I'm not ambitious to do the 6 month commitment of such a thing. What inspired that? What makes you go, all right, like, I can understand that doing that is, like, that's a pretty cool feat. But, you know, you have to love hiking to think that that's a brilliant
idea. And
that
was the thing. Actually, I was not really trying to go for the feat, like, the accomplishment.
Uh-huh.
I really just love hiking, and I love backpacking, and I love being outdoors. And this seemed like a good way to do that for a long period of time. So, You know, my feeling going into it was I actually never expected to complete the whole thing. I planned to complete the whole thing, but I just thought, you know, something, you know, I'll break something, I'll run out of money, something will happen, you know, it's more likely than not. I mean, most people who started don't finish it. And I thought, well, you know, odds are I probably won't, mm-hmm. something will happen and I won't finish it, you know. So, you know, when I hit 100 miles, I was like, great, that's 100 more than most of my friends have done. I've got credibility now. And then I hit 500, and then, you know, I just kept going. But really, it wasn't until about the last 500 miles where I really started to get attached to the idea of finishing it. So this would have been maybe middle of Oregon, and that was when I really started to feel like, okay, it would actually take something very major at this point for me to choose not to finish. Mm-hmm. But most people, actually, I won't say most people, a lot of people felt just the opposite, that they were going to feel like a failure if they did not finish. So just different mentalities. So for me, it really, when you ask what inspired me, mostly it was just, oh, it'd be great to be outdoors all the time.
So this is a nice way to do it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I'm thinking about goal setting, right? Mm-hmm. Like I when I was reading that in your book, kind of just you weren't tied to the outcome.
Yeah.
You were tied to the adventure,
yeah.
more so.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about that when I started running, I, you know, everybody says, you have to have a goal. You can't, you know, if you don't have a goal, you'll never complete your, and I sort of learned, it resonated with me because when I started running, I basically wasn't going to have a goal. Because for me, running is not my body's favorite thing to do.
Yeah.
So I had not really run like a 5K. And so when I started running, I was doing a zilch to 5K kind of thing.
Oh, cool.
And I was pretty confident I would never run the 5K.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so I was not setting that as a goal.
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up running the 5K.
Right.
And I think it was because I didn't set the goal.
Yeah.
I think if I would have set the goal, I would have actually not done as well. So it's an interesting thing.
That really resonates with me. I feel like setting a goal is really important for people who do well with goals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not for people who are more into the experience. And so, yeah, I just think it's probably just a lesson in not only knowing your own, you know, way of working, but also not projecting that onto other people. Because I definitely feel like the people who, you know, were very goal-oriented in the Pacific Crest Trail, I think they had every bit as great a time as I did, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
just the different
the
way our brains
mm-hmm.
and way we resonate and are inspired by things.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's just interesting because it's such a huge... I mean, you were at a point in your life then it was a good time, like, to do such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
What does it take to sort of plan? I mean, I'm just thinking about all of the details of making sure... this was all new to me in the concept of you having to plan out where would you stop? Where would you send packages for yourself? Where would you trade out equipment? Like, that just never occurred to me because totally new concept.
And believe me, there are people who hike the Pacific Crest Trail who it also never occurred to them, and they do okay.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So this gets, again, into different personality types, I think, and sort of how much inconvenience are you willing to put up with in exchange for not having to do a whole bunch of planning.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, some people... there was one guy on the trail. He had one of the thickest Southern accents, and his name was Dwayne, and people very affectionately referred to him as Insane Dwayne. Because I think, I don't know if you remember him from the book, but so most people are trying to keep their weight down. He had a massive backpack on his back and one on his front. So he was carrying two backpacks and he didn't carry any maps. And we're going through the desert, right? And he just said, oh, no, you know, God's going to provide for me. I don't need any maps. But, you know, he would go the wrong way a lot of times. So, I mean, in his case, I mean, he really could have died. I mean, that really, I don't want anyone to think you should ever, ever do this without a map. But I'm just saying he's kind of an extreme example of, you know, he was willing to put up with, like, the inconvenience of carrying so much extra weight just in case he should get really lost or whatever. because for him, he preferred that to planning.
Wow. So. Yeah, that it takes a high risk tolerance to. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
To do that.
Yeah, but so to answer your question sort of more directly about how I knew how to do the planning, you know, I'd done enough backpacking before. I had done quite a bit of the Appalachian Trail before, and so that I kind of learned there that you can actually mail things to yourself either at a post office and they'll hold it for you, or some businesses. So, and I knew, because I'd done enough backpacking, I knew that, you know, my ideal would be to go into town every 7 to 10 days. So, you know, I just kind of had a sense of those things, and then I was able just to look at a map and see, oh, there's a town, and then I would figure it out from there. But my preference was to buy groceries on the trail. The main research I did was just, wow, that town looks really small. I should see whether there's actually a grocery store there. And, you know, so a couple times I called up and I said, are you guys actually a real grocery store, or do you just sell potato chips and stuff? And if you sell potato chips, can I mail you a package, you know, to hold? And so just things like that I would do.
Wow. How much, like, time did you spend doing that? That, like, seems like a very big undertaking.
I was probably middle of the road in terms of how much time I spent doing it. I can't really put a number on it because all the planning kind of blurs together.
Sure, that makes sense.
But I would guess, I'm sure I spent a full day doing that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And then to actually head out on this big journey, I think I remember in the book that there was like a 7-day sort of hiking trial. So is that something that everybody does before they...
No. So I went to just a beautiful trail called the Ozark Highlands Trail down in Arkansas. It was really optional. I mean, to do some people, I typically have not done any training at all before I go on a hike.
Okay, so you just...
Typically, that's what I do.
Okay,
but in this particular case, I was pretty out of shape. And on the Pacific Crest Trail, unlike some other long hikes, the first couple days are actually pretty long days. So you do kind of have to come out of the gate with, you know, a little bit of chops. And so I could have done it, but I just thought, well, it'd be better to get a week of backpacking in somewhere. So, you know, I would love to do more of these small trails like the Superior Hiking Trail. You know, it's kind of like that, the Ozark Highlands Trail. There's like a number of them around the country that are just, you know, these smaller, maybe 300 to 500 mile trails that I think would be really fun to do all of them. So I didn't do all of the Ozark Highlands Trail, but I'd like to go back and do that one.
My brain is like all over the place with like all these thoughts, because it's just, I guess my question is, is it an unusual undertaking? Like, how many people do this? And I would assume you going in 2012 and now, it's got to be so different with cell phones. You know, just it has to be
completely
different.
Yeah, so I mean, when I started backpacking, it was, 1995 or something like that, you know. And at that time, it was a pretty unusual thing to do. I remember, you know, my fellow backpackers were just such great oddballs. Like, I met a guy who, instead of carrying a backpack, he had basically a little fanny pack, and then he had made these two hiking poles for himself that were made out of PVC pipe that he then threaded handles onto, and all of his gear was stashed in these PVC pipes that he used as a hiking pole.
Oh my goodness, that's creative.
I mean, yeah, it struck me as a bad idea, but it worked for him. But, you know, you just met all kinds of just strange, you know, people who just had their own way of thinking about things, just clever people. And now it's definitely become much more of an industry. You know, it's much more common, you know. So, I mean, I haven't been on the Appalachian Trail in a long time, but last time I was on there, I really didn't care for the culture, and it could have just been the people that I happened to be pacing with, but it was very much a hike really fast for 2 days, go into town, get totally drunk, and then come out and hike for 2 days and talk about how much you had to drink the last time, and then go in and get drunk again. I like to be outdoors. I like to be, you know, for me, it's, I do like the physical nature of it, but that's totally secondary for me. This primary thing for me is being outdoors, you know, finding little pieces of nature that you wouldn't see otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, your question about the phones is a really good one, because when I did it in 2012, I did carry a flip phone, and there were a few people who had smartphones, but not very many.
Uh-huh.
And so now well, the last time I took a long hike in 2016, I hiked most of the way across Norway. And I had a smartphone then. And, you know, I did use it as a navigational tool, which was great.
But the battery doesn't last that long.
The battery doesn't last, yeah. You have to be careful. You have to get the kind where you can, that because not all of them can you replace batteries on. So, I mean, mainly I was leaving my phone off and then only turning it on if I needed, you know, if I needed it for navigational help.
Mm-hmm.
Or to text Shane. But even so, most of the places that you're going to go out on the Pacific Crest Trail, there's not going to be a signal. So
that's what I was, yeah, that was, I guess, what was fascinating to me, because when you started mentioning phones in the book, I'm like, oh, I didn't, like, even occur to me that you would be, that you would have signal.
No,
out
even
there.
Now, most of the time, you're not going to have a signal okay. out there. So I think what a lot of people do is they use them to blog at night. But then they don't send it until they get to town or get a signal.
Okay. Yeah. When did people start hiking this trail?
Oh, yeah. So I think, I'm not sure I'm going to have the dates right, but I think it became a designated national scenic trail in 1994. But I don't think construction was only completed, maybe it was 1974, actually, that it was designated. But it was very, very choppy. And then, I can't remember. It'd be good to know when it actually was. But it's only, it hasn't been that long that the whole route has actually been complete. So,
okay. I'm going to hop in here with some factoids from ye olde Wikipedia. Wikipedia says that the PCT was designated a National Scenic Trail in 1968, but was not officially finished until 1993. And while I'm interrupting Gail, I might as well share a couple other fun facts that I've learned while researching these dates and give you a little bit of a water cooler conversation, which if you're doing this isolation thing right, will not be very soon. So hold these little factoids in your head for a while and then impress your friends from a distance. Okay, so the first person to hike the PCT from south to north was Richard Watson, who completed the trail in 1972, and he is the first PCT through hiker, so meaning he didn't have any vehicle assistance that might have helped him down maybe paved roads or through particular areas that Gail addresses in her book, and I think we're also going to talk about futuristically in the interview. There was a young man in 1970 who claimed to do the same thing and wrote a book about it, but was then sued by his publisher because they said he didn't actually complete it all on foot. He sued back for $3 million, a lot of money in 1970, holy cow, but backed the lawsuit down when people had said they had given him a ride. Still a feat, just not entirely true. Who knew? So much drama could come out of hiking. And then there's this other guy, Scott Williamson, who completed the yo-yo circuit, which means he walked it up and then he walked it back all through hiking. And it was his fourth attempt. Holy cow. Okay, then I just have to give this dude some love. Martin Papendick, who was the first known person to hike across three of the states of the PCT in 1952. But they say he doesn't really get much credit because he wasn't very well known. So you got to be famous, I guess. So I raise my cup to you, Martin Papendick, for being a brave pioneer. All right, let's get back to our brave, ambitious Gail Francis.
People who did it, you know, back in the day, tended to, you know, have to do a lot of bushwhacking and pathfinding themselves and connecting up with pre-existing routes and so forth.
And you're just a paper map? I mean, is that how?
Yeah, I mean,
paper map and a compass,
yeah,
to try to
just
figure out
map
how
and
you.
Compass. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I like, again, thinking about this and looking for a trail, and then how in the world do you find, like, you know, you at one point went off the trail,
oh, yeah.
and got lost,
yeah.
and finding your way back, and then finding your way on the trail, knowing it's the right trail.
Mm-hmm.
Desert. So, okay, just because this is a me not knowing thing. Desert, in my mind, I think of my experience with desert is the, you know, the big sandy area.
Mm-hmm.
Is it different where you were crossing the desert? I'm just thinking of navigating your way across there.
Well, still, even though it was desertous, I mean, it was desertous and mountainous both. And
okay.
So it's far harder to find your way for example, in the Boundary Waters than it is in the deserts of Southern California. Because in the deserts of Southern California, if you have your map and you have your compass, and, you know, the sun is pretty much always going to be out. Mm-hmm. So if you know, you have a sense of your directions. And then the mountains, you know, you're looking at your map and you can see, okay, that this mountain, this is probably the one that's on my map here based on the shape of it. You know, you learn how to read the contour lines on your map and so forth. And so you can kind of get a pretty good sense. I mean, you can still definitely get it wrong, but you can get a pretty good sense. You've got really good visibility and landmarks. Whereas in the Boundary Waters or, you know, Superior National Forest...
Trees.
You have trees. Exactly. And, you know, not even that many prominent large hills even, you know. So it's... I don't know for sure, but I suspect that far more people, especially percentage-wise, get lost and die probably in Superior National Forest than in the desert of Southern California. But I could be wrong.
Wow. Okay. And then how... You said so... I was at a talk that you did a little while back too about this, and you talked about that there's kind of a consistent number of people that typically do the trail each year. Do I remember that correctly?
Well, I think, so my understanding, and I would like to actually go back and verify all of this, look at the numbers for the last several years, but mm-hmm. my understanding is it's a consistent number of people who finish the trail.
Oh,
but
okay.
The people who have started the trail has vastly grown. So the year I started was at that time more people had started it than ever before. It was about 500 people and about 280 finished.
Okay.
And I was told, and I haven't verified this, that a few years back 11,000 people started the trail and about 280 finished.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, that's wow.
So I don't know. I think there are some changes afoot. I think in terms of how many people are being allowed to go through, I think there's now restrictions that they're doing and more education around, you know, how to camp and backpack responsibly. Because, I mean, the Pacific Crest Trail is actually not that challenging physically as far as trails go. I mean, the Appalachian Trail is actually a lot harder physically,
okay,
which is surprising to a lot of people because it's the Pacific Crest Trail is so much more remote. But it's actually a pretty gentle trail as these things go. And so really, a lot of people can do it without harming themselves or dying. Now, many people do still manage to die on this trail by doing really stupid things. And sometimes through other reasons, but primarily through doing stupid things. So the reality is, like, tons and tons of people can go, and then they all tell their friends, like, oh, like, it was easy, I did it, you should do it. And then, you know, everyone keeps going, and so... So now I guess it's becoming a bit crowded.
So. Okay. And this is a trail. I mean, you are pretty much walking. You're not climbing.
No, on the Pacific Crest Trail, there really are not any places where you really have to, climb hand over hand or even do really any crawling to speak of.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
And I know you talked about a few areas where that was like a log that you're crossing.
Yeah, I personally crawled over some logs that other hikers would not, but that's just because I get a little bit of vertigo. So.
Right? That seems like a reasonable, safe thing to potentially do. Describe, just because we should have done this at the beginning, but describe where it starts and where it ends.
Yeah. So it starts at the Mexican border, just south of San Diego, actually just south of a little community called Campo. And so it starts there at the wall. There's all these Homeland Security guards around. And so for me, it was a little just strange, you know, to start the hike in kind of this militarized way.
That would feel kind of awkward.
Yeah. And I don't know what the wall looks like now or what the militarization is now, but it was, it was really a kind of a militarized feeling. And then you go through, you know, a lot of scrub and stuff. And there are a lot of trails there that have been, you know, it can be a little bit confusing when I did it because there are a lot of side trails and so forth. But so that's kind of where it starts is kind of in this low desert, and then, but even through Southern California, so the first 700 miles are mainly desert, but even there, you do within the first few days, you still, you are still getting up into elevation. So, you know, I did have some snow in the first few days up at elevation, but mainly in those first 700 miles, your main concerns have to do with your water, you know, just making sure, okay, what are the water sources? How much do I need to carry to get there? And one of the cool things that other hikers do is when people, the first ones through, they'll often make a note about where the water sources are. And when they get to town, they would upload their information to this thing called the water report. So you could kind of get a sense of like, okay, well, as of 3 days ago, this creek was dodgy, so I better not count on it or something. And now, of course, that's been vastly improved because people have so much more technology that... So anyway, so that's like the first 700 miles is you're really like thinking about water. And then you end up in the High Sierras where water's not an issue. You asked how it ends, and then you're ending in this totally different, you know, boreal forest, you know, as you go into Canada. So it's quite an amazing experience and quite an amazing hike through ecosystems.
It sounds like it. I mean, just the different things that you're seeing and the different terrain that you're experiencing and the weather that you have to plan for and the timing that you have to create for yourself so that you're warm mm-hmm. enough and not going through areas where it's dangerous or too snowy that's kind of wild. I'm just thinking the people who've pioneered that, who started that.
I know.
Like what they must have gone through to sort of create that information. And how do you find all of that stuff out? I mean, is it like literally just reading or is there kind of like a source of, I want to do this and here's what you need to know?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. So one thing for me was because I already had experience as a backpacker, like there was sort of a category of things that I didn't have to find out about,
okay,
right?
Sure.
I mean, you know, just basic things like I roughly knew what gear I wanted and things like that. Although, you know, I definitely still learned a lot on the trail and have changed up my mind about certain types of gear. So that's like one barrier I didn't have to think about, but people who were just starting out, you know, to them it's all new, right? Like, mm-hmm. Whereas I knew kind of what it would feel like to hike for 20 miles. Like, I could picture kind of how my body would feel or how far I'd want to go, whereas someone else might think, I'll just do 35 miles, or, oh, I could never do 10 miles, or, you know. So that part I kind of knew already or knew enough about. Some of the other things in terms of, you know, the actual planning out of, okay, I know generally, but on this hike, how long will it take? Like, I'd never done a lot of desert hiking before, so I really didn't know, like, what will it feel like to hike, you know, will I end up hiking at night because it'll be cooler? I don't know. And so a lot of it comes from reading. For me, a lot of it came from reading. There were, at the time, sort of a series of guidebooks, three volumes of guidebooks. I think they're discontinued now. I think in part because everything's so accessible online these days. But I really liked the guidebooks because what I would do is I tore out sections and would take those sections with me because they also sort of told you a little bit about the, you know, the history of the area, just interesting things that you wouldn't know just by putting one foot in front of the other. Mm-hmm. So I really liked that. But yeah, mainly there's Facebook groups where people who are thinking about doing it will write in and say, hey, I'm thinking about this and that, here's a little bit about me, does this make sense? And people will give advice, sometimes in a snarky fashion, but usually in a helpful fashion.
Gotta love Facebook.
I know, right? Yeah.
Through this process, how often were you kind of at that place of wanting to give up? And how much did that kind of like shift how you did your days or how much time you took off?
Yeah. So I definitely was plagued by that much more through the desert. You know, here I had these boots that were the wrong boots. I also did, you know, like I had other gear that I was not, it just wasn't quite right. And I wasn't really, you know, yeah, I definitely was plagued by that feeling much, much more in the desert. And I would say there was at least twice that I can recall that I made a solid decision that I was going to quit the trail. But both times, I was actually on the trail, and it was like a 30-mile hike to get to a road. So by the time I got to a road, I was like, no, I'm going to keep going. So But you know, it really, really helped that there were so many people who every time I came to town, my email box would be full of people wishing me well. If it had been a place where I was getting packages, people would be sending me packages. And, you know, I just had so much support and encouragement, which was really amazing to me because I think of myself as kind of a loner. And so I guess I just didn't really realize how much there was going to be that outpouring of support. It was really, really one of the best things about hiking the trail was like actually was the human connection was kind of.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, I was never what I thought would end up being one of the best things about hiking. Yeah.
Wow. Well, and interesting, the human connection that you got from being distant from people. Mm-hmm. But you set out on your own. Mm-hmm. Like, I just think that in and of itself, being a loner or not, to just say, okay, yep, I'm going to do this, is kind of phenomenal. And you trekked a good chunk of it by yourself, but it's like there's an interesting trail culture of people that you ran across and how many people helped each other.
Yeah. No, the people on the trail are great. I mean, I think I did struggle with it a little bit at first just because I was I was a woman, I was 39 when I started the trail, and most people on the trail are sort of these young men in their 20s. Young white men in their 20s is the primary demographic of people hiking the trail.
Okay.
Probably followed by young white women in their 20s, and then you know, people who are like men who are like retirement age, who maybe retired a little bit earlier, probably the third biggest demographic.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So really not a lot of people who like in the late 30s, early 40s say, I think I'm going to hike the trail.
Right. Well, if you're in the whole work-life thing to take 6 months off.
Right. And most people, you know, a lot of people have kids and stuff. Right. And so, you know, so I just kind of struggled with, you know, not exactly finding my people. Plus I'm a very political person, and you know, most people on the trail are just kind of like, oh, man, the news is bullshit, man. This is what's real.
So, which, there's a truth to that. I can understand that.
You know, you can take that idea too far, but you can also take being political too far.
Right. yeah, well, and one of the fun parts about your book is reading about all of the people that you met and the different personality types and the different approaches that they took. Mm-hmm. And it is a cast of characters.
Yes.
I really enjoy that. And I enjoy that you keep meeting people. I mean, I just think it's a culture that I just don't know anything about. Mm-hmm. So learning that you keep running into each other and you leapfrog each other and that you're leaving each other's notes and water, it's like, oh, wow. Okay. That almost seems like doable. Like it just feels very different.
It's awesome.
Not competitive.
No.
You know, which is really nice. Cause you're out there. I can imagine it's life or death. You don't.
Yeah, that's right.
A little bit a wrong step, a not enough water, not enough food, often a wrong trail. Good luck, man.
Yeah.
You know, so it's such, it just seems so huge. It's just amazing. I don't know. I think it's a very cool and brave thing to do.
Oh, thank you.
Again, I don't have a lot of experience backpacking, so obviously you come with that experience, but just to be able to say, yep, I'm going to do this, I think is pretty phenomenal.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, no, it's cool. And your book is, I really enjoy the book. You have a fantastic writing style.
Well,
I recommend anybody to read it. You're very open about your experiences, which I think is so beautiful because it paints a picture. I mean, I feel like I walked through the forest with you, you know, and the trip with you and have such a movie in my mind, which is delightful to read. And it was just an enjoyable experience. And I have to laugh because the first time you said pop, I was like, yes.
Oh, that's funny. I never even thought about that. As opposed to soda.
And
that's really funny.
That stuck with me through the whole thing. That was like, yeah, pop. All right. This is definitely a Midwestern written book.
I did not even think about that. You were the first person who has commented on that.
Oh, really?
But I'm sure there are a lot of people who have gotten a chuckle out of it.
I was like, when you said that, it was like, yeah. Oh, one question. question I do have, just because of my own kind of curiosity. Okay, so you're on the trail, and you go to the town, and you plan to go to the towns. First of all, I think it's amazingly impressive that you're able to sort of go, this is how long it's going to take, and be pretty on mark. Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of wild. But how long is the jaunt off the trail to the town? I mean, I know it's totally different for each one, but it's not like the trail just kind of swoops into town and goes back.
There's only, like, one or two places where the trail actually goes into town. So, some places it's as short as a mile. I think the longest one was maybe 26, 27 miles, where you really had to hitchhike.
Wow. Okay, yeah. Yeah.
So it really, really varied a lot. It's hard to say there was one, but most of them, mostly I wouldn't go to a town if it was more than probably 10 miles. So,
okay.
And even then I liked to try to plan it to only go to towns that were less than 5 miles.
Just so you could kind of get there on your own and not have to depend on the hike.
I mean, hopefully I could catch a ride, but if I didn't, I knew that, you know, it wasn't going to take a whole day to walk to town.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's a little bit of an investment.
It is. And also, the other thing is, I think this comes through in the book, but I really hate walking on roads, not so much because of traffic or whatever, but because it's actually quite painful on my feet. You know, you're used to just walking on, you know, the desert sand or, you know, the forest floor. And so then to start walking on pavement is actually excruciating. So that was the big reason I didn't like to do road walking.
Is that true for everybody or just is that a you thing?
I think it's true for pretty much all hikers, although I think I could be more of a wimp than most.
I know you had mentioned in the book, like, your body was used to walking so that when you tried to, like, do other things, your body was like, yeah, no.
Right, yeah. Doing this. That's right.
Get used to this muscle. It is interesting because it's a muscle memory. I mean, even though you're on a trail, so you're doing more than just walking.
Right.
But it's for that long a time, you know, you didn't, like, just do tons of yoga in the middle of the...
No. I did do some to try to not get too stoved up.
Yeah. And you didn't have any major injuries during this at all, did you?
Well, the only thing I had was I threw my back out at one point.
Okay.
Yeah, so that could have been serious, but it wasn't. I was okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and hence you finished.
Right, I still managed to finish.
And one of the thoughts I had, too, was just... thinking about being 6 months away from the world, the normal everyday life, the news, the, you know, to catch up with people who are walking along with you. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking, like, oh my God, what a beautiful thing that would be.
Oh, for sure.
To be away. I mean, how much did you sort of, like, have to acclimate getting back into the world of everyday people in life?
It changed. Of all the things that changed for me, I think this was one of the biggest things, was being away. So, you know, I will say, when I left, this was 2012, so in, just a little background, in 2010, I was living in Wisconsin when I did the trail, and in 2010 was when... Scott Walker was elected, and then he took office in 2011. And the first thing that he did was to eliminate collective bargaining rights for public employees. The reason I'm going into all of this is because he was really one of the first people in the country to really basically say, like, look, I won by a narrow margin, and now I am going to completely impose these very far right-wing things. Now, by today's standards, you know, attacking unions seems kind of cute and quaint, but it was actually a really major deal, and there were walkouts all over the state. Students, schools shut down, both in rural and urban areas. It was major, and 30,000 people occupied the Wisconsin Capitol for a week over this. So it was really a very big deal, and it was a big deal to me, and I was part of that activism against Walker's efforts to attack the unions and working people. And so anyway, this was like one of the early fissures into this extreme polarization we now have. I mean, again, looking back on that, it just seems so quaint, but it was, you know, it was extremely polarizing, and you know, I think rightfully I felt very angry about a lot of things, but also I was also very energized and so forth. And people on the other side also were feeling very energized because here they had a champion, you know, and so forth. So it was, the polarization was really very, very powerful. So here I am in the midst of this, and then I pick up and go into the woods for 6 months. And it was really the best thing for me, because it just was a really great reminder that basically people are good, even though we have very different ideas about how to be good in the political arena. And also that there's actually a lot that we can talk about. And so, you know, most of the people I was hiking with, I had no idea what their political views were or if they had political views. Most of us did not talk about politics. Most of us talked about our bowel movement, you know?
Right.
Which you might argue there's not a big difference between those things. But so anyway, or I just wasn't talking at all because I was just on my own and, you know, and I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about, you know,
your next
flower or the next, more likely the next meal, right?
Right.
I mean, it was really basic. I just got down to like really basic things like when can I eat and when am I going to poop? Like basically that's what consumed my thoughts. And
simplicity.
So I want to be careful how I say this because I don't subscribe to the belief that, oh, you know, we should just all get along. You know, politics isn't that important. I do think it's important. And I think we shouldn't allow our politics to obscure the fact that we humans can connect with each other in many different ways, not just through the confrontation, you know, through a heated political confrontation, but that there's more to being human than that. And so I think that is one of the biggest things that I have carried through with me. Even though I'm still a very political person, I think I'm a better person as well.
That makes sense. I mean, you are getting to, it's such a shift to be in the middle of the woods for that long. And when we talk about being starved for nature and to just sort of set yourself in that place and then have to, in a sense, rely on other people, even though that's not what you're planning on when you started the trail, I imagine, but you end up kind of doing that through the process.
Right, yes.
And that you have, you are in survival mode, you know, there's the enjoyment, but there is survival mode. And if you can all come together on that, I mean, I think if we could do that in general of the whole, there's, yes, there's these differences, but can we come together? Can we understand each other enough to know what the similarities are? Because often people want the same things, but they never get to that part because of these other issues that are polarizing them, which is harmful to us.
Right. So, I mean, like, I want to be clear. I still believe in fighting for what's right. Like, I don't think, like, oh, you know, what these times call for is us all just, like, sitting down and having coffee. I don't think that's the answer.
Right.
But I still think we should sit down and have coffee or go for a hike together.
Right. Well, It's that finding the common ground because, in my mind, if you can find the common ground and you can find how you can connect, you start to look at how you don't connect potentially differently, but you see the humanness in each other. And it's like, okay, you want this thing over here, but you're human and I care about you. And how can we understand what you want and what I want and what can we... And obviously people are going
to
have...
So I know that's, that seems like kind of a strange thing to say on a podcast where I'm supposed to be talking about hiking, but it is it has been one of the lasting influences, I think, from the hike for me.
That's cool. It's an experience you can't have unless you have it.
Yeah.
You know, and what you take away from that, you know.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and like you had mentioned, just the difference in the vegetation and the flowers and the everything must have just been... a phenomenal walk through, you know, you're walking south to north. That's just got to be amazing.
Great. Yeah.
I read your audiobook. Does your print book have pictures?
The print book has pictures. Okay. Yes, it does.
If you had it to do all over again, what would you do? What would you do differently in whatever piece of that, whether it's the prepping or the travel or the way you communicated or connected?
Well, I will say, I'm not a person who is always looking back over my shoulder and thinking I should do things differently. So, you know, you mentioned that you might ask me this question. So I've been thinking about it because it's not something I have a ready answer for. But I will say maybe two things. One is the only actual regret I have about the hike has to do with my animals. So my dog in particular, my dog Anna, she was, maybe 11 or so when I did the hike. And very loving, sweet dog. And I had great dog sitters for her. So I thought she would be fine. But the truth is, she was really never the same after that.
Oh, wow.
So that is a genuine regret I have. And it's a big enough regret that, you know, it's definitely kept me from doing more hikes, you know, because I have another dog now. And it's definitely kept me from doing more long hikes. So that is something to think about. But then the other thing I thought about was, you know, in spite of what I said about me being very comfortable as a backpacker and knowing what gear I wanted, the truth was, in those initial weeks and maybe month, I did have a lot of insecurities too. You know, here I was around these other people who just seemed to have, you know, I mean, 20-year-old white guys, talk about self-confidence, right? I mean, like they just seemed to have everything all figured out. And here I was with, you know, maybe some outdated gear and outdated ideas. And so I think, you know, all of that was needless. I was great. I was totally, you know, I knew what I was doing. And so I think maybe the one thing I would say is I do wish I hadn't compared myself to other people. I think it would have been a much easier and more enjoyable first few weeks and month or so, you know, if I had just not compared myself to others.
Mm-hmm. I would think that would take a little bit of time to sort of get over just as you walk out. And I mean, it sounds like you kind of did get to that point of confidence, which is pretty cool.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Out of all the things you've gained from the experience, what is a takeaway that you might give other people?
Yeah. Well, I would say two things, actually. The first is to show kindness and support to people, because I could not have done this dream without all of the support that came completely unexpected from other people. And there's no way I can pay that back except for trying to be supportive to friends and to strangers and to say, good job, go get it, you can do it, you know. So that actually kind of gets me to the second thing, which, you know, I think one of my favorite things when I'm giving a book talk is to ask people, hey, let's, you know, I did this hike because I love hiking and I just wanted to be outdoors and wake up in the woods every morning. And to do that for 6 months, to do something that you love for 6 months, is really, really good for you. So for me, it wasn't about achieving the goal. For me, it was for 6 months, I got to do something I loved. And so I like to ask people, if you were going to take 6 months to do something that you love, maybe pursue a dream that you've never done, maybe something you just think you would love, but you've never had a chance to try, or something you just wish you could do all the time, like, what would it be? Just a good thing to leave your listeners with to think about. What would that be? And is there some portion of it is there some way I could do some version of the Pacific Crest Trail, but not the actual trail, although if that's your thing, go for it. But like, is there some way I could do something I love for that long?
Well, and it's an interesting thought because, you know, that was all immersing for you, right? But, you know, you think about, can you commit to something else for 6 months that maybe is part of your day or a routine or something and say, okay, well, this is what I'm going to do. So maybe I'm not going to be around as much or I'm not going to do this, but this is what I want to do to help fulfill my own dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very cool. This is really cool. I don't know if I would have picked up this book if I didn't know you, but I'm glad that I did because I think it's just a really interesting window into something that is really unfamiliar to me. I mean, I love nature, but the idea of, like, safety, if I could be out in the middle of the woods and I knew I could be completely safe,
yeah,
I'd be like, okay, I would love to have that experience.
Uh-huh.
But I don't have my own securities and skill sets that I'd probably be more okay than I think I would.
Uh-huh.
But I think that window into that experience was just really fun. And I think you paint a really amazing and thorough picture of it that I think is, it's fun to read and it's fun to sort of experience vicariously. And, you know, I think I will probably walk trails here a little bit differently and, mm-hmm. and think about that a little bit more of just the, wow, what would it be like to do this for mm-hmm. such a huge amount of time? Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you wrote the book and shared that experience with everybody because I think it's a really big deal.
I really appreciate you having me on. It's really fun to get to talk about it. So thank you.
Awesome. So everybody go out and read it. Because it's really, it's an enjoyable read whether you are a hiker or not.
Should we tell them one more time? It's called Blisters, B-L-I-S-S, parentheses, T-E-R-S.
And they can find it on Amazon. I'll put it up in the show notes for sure.
Yep, and you can get it locally at Zenith and Fitgers. So.
Perfect, okay. Is there anything else people should know as far as contacting, like, do you want to do more speaking things?
Oh, I love doing speaking things.
Okay, yeah, so sure. How would people, what's the best way to contact you if they would like you to come in and speak for them?
They could reach out to me at my email address, which is gailmfrancis@yahoo.com. I can leave my phone number here, right? Is
that sure.
715-558-4544.
Good deal. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Don't forget the talk on Thursday, April 2nd at 7:30 Central Time. Again, that link will be in the show notes. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I just found the whole journey and the prepping and the time, just all of it is so intriguing to me. I hope it was for you too. I certainly enjoy walking trails and running trails, and I've spent very few nights of my life outside camping, sleeping on the ground. I did have one night in Duluth that I nearly spent outside unplanned, lost in the woods. But that's a whole nother story. Anyway, thanks to my running coach and her dog, me and my companion did not get stranded outside. So very good. Thank you so very much for listening. You know, it feels really awkward to even mention or ask for your support on Patreon. And part of me feels like I shouldn't. And I feel a little more encouraged when I'm listening to podcasts that have support and funding and all that kind of thing. And they're saying, hey, this is a really important time. If somebody has the ability to help, you know, they're asking and reminding people, we need your help more than ever. And I'm kind of in that same boat. I feel horrible about asking. I know that I am not out there risking my life every day to save lives and get sick. And I totally get that. So obviously, whatever you feel called to do, whatever you can do, but please know that for me, again, the podcast is something that at this point I make no income on, and I have lost the part-time income that I did have for the time. So if it is something that you can do and to support me and my mission and this art form, please do consider. I do think that sometimes people doing podcasts, because podcasts are so much like radio, they are very easy to forget about because, you know, they're just there. We're kind of used to something like that. It's kind of like talk radio. And for artists putting out songs, you can make sense of paying for the song or buying the record. Putting out a podcast each week for me is not just a, you know, sit down, take an hour and put it out there. It is really a lot of work. I spend a lot of hours doing this. So I am grateful to be home and have some extra time, but I am really not much less busy. And that's probably me needing to figure out how can I do things more efficiently. And as I said in one of the other podcasts, probably need to learn to edit a little bit less because that is where I spend a lot of my time. And I love doing it. And it's an art form that I enjoy and love creating with that. So that's a really hard thing for me to give up because I want to make everybody sound as good as possible. But just know if podcasts are not something you're familiar with and you're listening to this, whether it's mine or somebody else that you're supporting, first of all, thank you for recognizing that as something worth supporting. But know that, you know, this isn't something that I have income coming in every month. I have my Patreon supporters, and that absolutely, absolutely helps with the cost of doing the podcast. And I am so grateful for the Patreon supporters. And if you are somebody who wants to be a Patreon supporter, you can go to the webpage, for the podcast, which is wellnessrenpodcast.com. And you will see on the left, there is a Become a Patron button, and that's going to bring you to Patreon. Patreon is a different page. It's somebody else that handles the payments. So that's nothing that I see ever, but it is something that helps support me each month. You can do it for as long. You can quit anytime you need to. So if you just want to do something for a few months or one time, you can totally do that. And I want to say that because that is something that I know from talking to people that they have misconceptions about and don't really understand. So if you ever have any questions, you are welcome to shoot me an email at judy@wellnessren.com. There's also an email on the podcast page too. You're welcome to use that as well. So thank you for understanding and getting along with my awkwardness, because I, like Gail, I am not great at promoting myself, and it's really hard for me to say, hey, can you support what I'm doing? So again, thank you to all of those people who are my Patreon subscribers. I value you so much, and it really, really does mean a lot to me. And for those of you who are considering or future supporters, I also appreciate that as well. And again, passing along the podcast is huge. If you are buying stuff from Amazon right now, go to the website wellnessrenpodcast.com, click on support the podcast, and you can buy through. If you click through to Amazon on that page, anything you buy in that purchase, a little bit of it goes to the podcast. So if you don't have extra money to spend, and I totally get that right now, that is a way you can do it without it costing you any money. So thank you, thank you, thank you for being here, for listening to me right now. And I hope that you are safe and healthy and happy in your home. I know this is a very strange time for all of us. So take good care, take caution, take that extra time that you need to clean your groceries, clean your car handles, your steering wheel. I posted a link on Facebook this morning. I can't remember if I put it on my personal page. I think I did too, about a person who had bone marrow transplant and had to live for, like, I think 18 months doing this exact thing. So she talks about what is logical and why those are the things that we need to do and how we get into those habits. All right, enough of me. Thank you so much. May you continue to find the pieces that fit beautifully into your health and wellness puzzle during this crazy time. Take care, and we'll see you next time.